Everyone, and welcome to Book Hype, episode number 105. Today, as usual, I'm joined by Brittany. Hi, Brittany.
Hi.
And we also have a special guest, author of one of my book club books, which was Undertow, and of course, Raging Sea, Michael Buckley. Hello.
Hi, everybody.
Thank you so much for agreeing to come on here and chat with us. It feels like it was forever ago when I met you in BEA and kind of proposed it to happen, but now it's actually happening, and that's very exciting.
Well, I really appreciate you being persistent about it, because I have a tendency to say, yeah, I'll do that. And then when the people are like, well, let's go do it, I'm like, oh, my ADD is kicking in. So I'm really glad you were you stuck with it. I'm happy to be part of it. I'm worried that you have done 105 episodes before this. Mm. Before you finally got to me.
To be fair, the past three we talked about Pride and Prejudice, so.
Oh, okay. All right.
We just wanted to make sure we had plenty under our belt before we got to you, so we were sticking the pros.
Oh, so the 105 were just practices.
Yes, this is the real book hype.
Welcome. Finally. Okay,
well, I'm really
Okay, well, what we usually do is start off with what we've been reading recently and kind of just talking about, you know, a little bit about what it's about and, you know, what we liked about it and that sort of thing. So if you have something prepared, would you like to go first?
Well, the book I just finished is called The Game of Love and Death, and it's by Martha Brockenbrough. And I don't know if you guys know this book, but Martha is sort of this, like, jack of all trades. I mean, she's a musician. She's written a lot of, like, kids' nonfiction books. And I think that The Game of Love and Death is her first, it might be her first YA book. And it's really, like, a home run for me. It has a little bit of kind of Neil Gaiman magic in it. The premise is that love and death are timeless, immortal beings. And every once in a while, they make a wager where they pick one man or one woman or, you know, whatever a couple could be. It could be two men, two women. And in this one, they pick a white guy and a black girl during the 30s. And the thing is like the wager is that love believes that the couple, no matter how hard their lives are, if they stay together, will choose love. And death believes that the problems of the world will be too much, and that the people will decide to break up. And they love and death start to meddle in this relationship. And death makes it insanely harder. And I loved it. It was it was kind of like I realized that, like, Neil Gaiman doesn't actually write love stories. So this was like Neil Gaiman's love story, but written by Martha Brockenbrough. Yeah, and Martha's a friend of mine, and I just adore her. She's really super talented and, like, just very thoughtful and kind person. And this book, I was just stunned at how good it was.
That sounds really interesting. I'm probably going to add that to my ever-growing to-be-read list.
And then the other book I've been reading that I finished was by Courtney Scheinmull, who is another person who has made a name writing for much younger kids. And this was her first YA book. It's called Edgewater, and it's sort of like it's like Grey Gardens for teenagers. It's about a teenage girl whose mother has run off with her boyfriend, leaving her and her sister in the care of their very eccentric aunt. And there's a trust fund. And they've been using it to, like, fund their lives, but the house that they're living in is completely falling apart. And this is a house that's in a very upper crust kind of neighborhood, like something you might see in the Hamptons. And she, you know, meets this boy who is sort of famous. He's like a kid. He's like a boy Kardashian. And they fall for each other. And it's there's a political story and some intrigue and there's a death. And I was completely swept away by it. Courtney actually spent a lot of time with horses because the equestrian is a big part of the novel. And so she apparently went to some horse ranch, I guess, here in New York and spent almost every day getting to know horses and how they're fed and how they're taken care of and the, you know, different ways you can ride them. And you can really tell the research is in the book. And I actually learned quite a lot about horses in a way that I didn't expect, but I loved that book as well. Those are the two books I read recently that I've just adored.
Awesome. They both sound fantastic. And Brittany, what have you been up to?
Well, I read Raging Sea by Michael Buckley, but we'll talk about that in a little
really
bit.
It's really good.
Yeah, I heard it's okay. so I finished that, and then this weekend I watched Trainspotting, which is one of my favorite movies, and so I picked up the sequel to Trainspotting, Porno, which I have never read, and it takes place 9 years after Trainspotting. And it focuses on Sick Boy's story, where he decides to like fix up this pub because he thinks it's going to be this awesome, like new hip place that everyone wants to go, but it's not. And so he catches wind of like this porn industry that's thriving in London, and he decides to rent out the top of the pub to these people. And all the characters from Trainspotting are back, and you know, it all falls apart. I won't give it away. But I really picked this up and watched Trainspotting because I'm getting really excited that they're going to be filming this sequel this year, because it's been about 10 years since Trainspotting came out, and this book takes place 9 years after Trainspotting, and the entire original cast is back to work with Danny Boyle, who's adapting it again. So I'm very excited about that. That's what I've been reading.
Do you watch Elementary with Johnny Lee Miller?
Karen, do I watch Elementary with Johnny Lee Miller? Yes. It is my favorite television show.
You've discussed that in all 105 previous episodes.
At least, yes, absolutely. No, I adore Elementary. I think it's brilliant. In fact, I spent half of today writing an article about Elementary that I'm going to continue writing after we wrap this up. So, yeah, I am...
I love that, too. Yeah. I think it's a great show.
Yeah, I'm in very deep with Elementary.
You've invested the time. Lucy Liu will thank you.
Yeah, and Brittany's dragged me into it as well. And I'm behind right now, but I'm definitely invested once I can get some time to catch up.
Do you feel like there's a pressure now? You know, like... This is something I was thinking about this morning was, you know, it seems like everybody binge watches television now. Do you feel like there's a pressure to actually binge watch a show?
The list that I have is unbelievable, and it's so overwhelming that I can't watch anything. Like, I end up rewatching old stuff because I'm like, I just can't commit to 15 hours of this show. I just can't do it.
Yeah, like, if you watched it, like, at a leisurely pace, like, one episode a week, you'd be some sort of nerd now. Like, you have to watch, you have to basically throw your life away for every show that you're interested in now. It's kind of a fascinating phenomenon, this binge watching.
Yeah, I even get overwhelmed if I miss a week of anything and I have to watch two episodes, and then it just keeps piling up, and I'm like, I don't know what to do, and then I can't read anything. It's so bad.
I wonder if there's any research on how many times binge watching has wrecked a relationship.
I would read that.
I think if anybody knows, it's Netflix.
Yeah.
It's from their hate mail.
Like,
that's where you
got
to go.
Pretty much, you know, that almost ruined my life, Breaking Bad.
I watched that live, thank goodness. Yeah. Otherwise, my life would have been thrown away.
And I have a friend who just went on, like, a vacation. I think they went to, like, somewhere tropical. And they spent a huge chunk of this tropical vacation watching Jessica Jones. And I was like, you guys are insane.
I mean, but Jessica Jones is pretty great, though.
It is. It's fantastic, but I think that I'd, I think I could put it away for.
Yeah, the only pressure I really feel is with House of Cards, because that's one I don't want spoiled, and if I don't watch it right away, forget it. I started watching it at work the last time it came out, like, in the afternoon, because no one was there. I'm like, well, I could get 3 episodes in before I go home.
I just want to get it out of the way because I'm ashamed of the shows that I love, and I don't want anyone to ever, like, pull up my Netflix queue and go, what is with this guy? Oh my lord. How many episodes of Doctor Who can one person watch?
All of them, multiple times.
I'm so bad, I've actually gone online to find the first and start at the first.
Trust me, you're talking to the right people here. Yeah. This is literally what we do. Watch TV and write about it.
And sometimes books. Like, every now and then we read a book and we talk about it on Book Hype. We've only ever read 105 books, though. So.
Well, you clearly need to slow down. It's too many books.
Well, speaking of books, this week I have been listening to Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, which we've talked about multiple times on Book Hype, and I finally picked up. And it's by Benjamin Alire Sayans, and of course I got the audiobook because it's narrated by my favorite person in the entire world, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and I absolutely love it, and Brittany was pretty happy that I started it and totally guessed that I was listening to the audiobook. I haven't finished it yet. I still have 2.5 hours left, but it's absolutely beautiful, and it makes me more excited that the author has recently announced a sequel. So,
I heard that that Lin-Manuel actually wrote some musical or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's...
something about it.
I mean, it's okay. Karen and I may or may not have seen it together.
I went a few months ago. I have to admit, it's spectacular.
Yeah, it is. We won the lottery, first of all, so that was exciting.
Oh, that's pretty awesome. My mother-in-law worked in theater for many, many years. So she sometimes has the inside track on getting good tickets. Ooh. So she helped us with that. I love it. I honestly do. But I'm getting to a point where I'm like, I'm tired of hearing about this. Like, it is just so pervasive here in New York City. Like, you can sit in coffee shops and people are just, they never stop talking about it.
I work in a theater production office, and it comes up in every single conversation. It doesn't matter if you're talking about the copier. Like, it just comes up.
It is totally revolutionary. I know when I finished watching it, I thought that it was a game changer. Like, it just is so fresh and unique on every level that it makes everything else on Broadway seem a little tame.
Yeah, you'll find no complaints from me. I've literally been listening to the soundtrack since we saw it in October, I think. I don't think I've listened to anything else, so I'm one of those terrible people that is willing to talk about it all the time. But I will save you that torture. And we will jump ahead. And first of all, I want to tell our listeners once again that our March book is going to be The Shadow Queen by CJ Redwine. So make sure you pick that up and give it a read and let us know what you think. And we'll be talking about it in a couple of weeks, because by the time this episode comes out, it will be March, which kind of terrifies me, but is a thing that is happening and that I cannot stop. So
we even had an extra day in February. And
we did. It's not enough.
Technically, tomorrow is March, but it has crept on you incredibly fast.
Yeah. Okay, I want to get into a little interview section about Raging Sea, because I'm very excited, like I said, to have you on the podcast. I picked up Undertow I got it at BEA and, you know, didn't know anything about it, just read it, absolutely fell in love, told everyone that we had no choice but to do it on Book Hype. And then when Raging Sea came out, just picked it up and read it as fast as I possibly could and really enjoyed it. So thank you for writing it because I love it.
Oh, well, that's very nice. they did pay me. It wasn't completely altruistic.
So did you get a bonus for ending it like that? Because that was just ridiculous. Where you're like, well, the money's good, so I'll just end it like this.
No, I knew that I had to write three of them, so I figured, well, I'll just rope the people in with this ending. I actually, my first series that I guess the first books I ever wrote was a series called The Sisters Grimm. And there were nine of them, and every one but the last one ended on a cliffhanger. And these were middle grade books. And I remember talking to my editor when I finished the first book, and I said, you know, would it be all right if I did that? And she goes, well, some people might like it. Like, a lot of people might want to burn you at the stake. But it turned out to be like a really great thing for that series. I don't want that to be my gimmick or anything, but it just felt like this was a moment to sort of let everybody know that the next thing that happens is going to happen immediately, and we're going to try and get Lyric out of all that trouble as quickly as we can.
Let's hope so. Please. Yeah. Please. Well, my first question is, and this is kind of throwing back to what you're talking about with the research that the other author did about horses and everything, is what's some of the coolest / weirdest things that you've learned while doing research on underwater creatures coming up with all the different alpha?
Well, there was the first thing I discovered, that there was such a rich multicultural history with mermaids, that they literally pop up in every corner of the world, even places that are sort of landlocked. I mean, Native American tribes who lived in the Great Plains had stories of mermaids that lived in the rivers. So this was something that I found stories from everywhere about them, and mermaids had a really wild, a varying example of what they would look like. Some of them, a lot of them are described as men. The female mermaid is actually sort of a lot lesser known. And, you know, they have oftentimes had green hair, and instead of fish tails, they would have snake tails. There were just so many varieties. So that was kind of cool, finding out that they were just everywhere. And then the other thing that was kind of interesting was all the research I did on bizarre deep sea animals, which, if you've ever gone online, I mean, this is a really fun and crazy thing to do, is just go online and Google deep sea animals, and you'll find things that come right out of science fiction sometimes, animals that you can't even believe are real. And that sort of took over a lot of what I was doing with the characters, was trying to create my own mermaid and try to add something to that mythology. But I used all these real animals to help me describe them. One of the things I wanted to do was create a brand new mythology for mermaids, because I think that people sort of understand what they are, and in many ways I think a lot of people can be bored with them, and so making them something fresh and exciting and dynamic was the main goal, and I hope it did that. I wanted to try to make them reflect what our world is like and how there are many different kinds of human beings on the planet, with different religions and different skin colors and different traditions, and why wouldn't that be the same underwater? So that was really the idea, and I had a lot of fun coming up with these different species that live under this empire.
Yeah, I think it worked out great. I mean, that's how I originally pitched the book to the book club, was like, look, guys, it's about mermaids, but they're not really the mermaids that you think of when you think of mermaids. And I kind of explained it a little bit, and they're like, okay, that's interesting. And they all gave it a try, and they're like, wow, yep, it was different. And it was really a cool twist on it, I think.
Another thing I wanted to do was really just take mermaids out of the water, which doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, but but I read a lot of mermaid novels researching this, and to be honest, I was like, there are really only 6 or 7 different ways to describe water, and I think this is boring the audience. And the truth is, I'm not even really a great swimmer. I've never gone snorkeling. I've never gone into deep water, so I wouldn't do a very good job of describing the bottom of the ocean. I can barely describe the bottom of a kiddie pool. So this was something that I just felt when you read so many of these mermaid novels, and there are many exceptions, but what I read was a lot of like Harry Potter underwater, or Twilight underwater, or you know, it was all the same kind of thing, but they just, you know, had them with fishtails and stuff. And I just wanted to take them out of the water. I think that was the part that bored me to tears about the ones I read.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly different, and I think it's better because of that. And Raging Sea in particular is, it feels bigger to me, both in location because of how much she travels, how much Lyric travels, and action. The action is so big, especially towards the end of the book. How did you handle that? How hard was it to kind of like keep all of those pieces moving and have that big scale, but also keep the plot moving as well?
You know, coming up with what I call the set pieces, or which is like the beats of the big moments in a book, for me, that doesn't really challenge me much. Cause when I'm writing the book, you know, I can kind of see it unfold in my head the way you might see a movie. So writing down what I'm seeing in my head is really what happens. And, so like in that building action stuff, it's very natural. I know I've listened to writers talk about how, you know, you should really do this and this and this to build conflict, but it just seems like a science project when they describe it that way. And to me, it's more like magic. It just kind of unfolds and happens. I think the biggest challenge of this book was that the cast was much bigger than the first one. Mm-hmm. And I had to juggle a lot of children who make up a big part of the cast, and trying to make them unique individuals. I had never worked with that many characters before. But the whole premise of the second book is to not only take the mermaids out of the water, but take them out of their comfort zones and take the main character out of the comfort zone and put her somewhere that you wouldn't expect, which would be a detention camp. So I did a lot of research on Guantanamo Bay and what the cells look like there. How they hold the prisoners, how they interrogate them. And a lot of that went into the book. So those kind of like details just add to the conflict and the crisis. And then these crazy things start to happen, and I just let them happen and I write them all down.
Yeah. Brittany, I don't know about you, but that prison section was really rough. It was really rough to read and to see Lyric go through all of that.
Especially because Lyric is like this character who is very good at calculating what type of situation she's in. So you're watching her in this and you're like, oh, she's going to take this now, or oh, she's going to fight back here. So it's like you never knew like what she was going to play to her advantage and when she was going to do that. And so this whole time she's in this camp, I'm like, I was uncomfortable, but I also like knew that she would be able to figure something out. So it was just really well built. And I think Lyric, I wouldn't want to see any other character go through it. I'd rather just see Lyric because like, I kind of know she's going to make it through.
I've gotten a couple letters where people have been angry about what Lyric has to go through in that book. But it is, you know, even though there's creatures that are sort of half human and half, you know, mermaid in the book, the things that happen to her are very real. I mean, we do put people through those kind of paces in these detention centers. I wanted to show that, like, the books have always had sort of a political vibe, running through them. Like the first book is really about the civil rights movement, and this one is really about, you know, post 9/11 America, and you know, how the sometimes tragic things we did for our own safety. Even though, you know, she's surrounded by people who are who can breathe underwater, the tortures and tragedies that happen in that prison are based on things that actually do happen.
Right. And I think for better or for worse, that kind of answers my next question, which is, if this were to really happen, if something like the Alpha were to really come up on our beaches, you know, do you think humanity would react this way, or do you think that they would have more empathy?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I started writing the book and I gave it to a couple of people, they said, "Oh, you know, this is such a dark interpretation of human nature." And would we really do that? And then luckily, we're in the middle of an election where we have a number of candidates who are sort of, you know, proposing some of the ideas that happen in this novel, building giant fences, like with tracking people, guarding, putting guards on them. I mean, these are things I've heard in debates. I think that there would be, like most things in America, there would be a group of people that would want to welcome them, and then there would be a group of people that would be very much against it. I like to think that, like, America is a country that has a lot of potential that we don't always live up to, but we usually learn from our mistakes, I think, and I think that we would handle it badly, but I'd like to think that in the end we would get it together.
I think that in this book in particular, in Raging Sea, I mean, even in Undertow, obviously, Lyric is sort of the saving grace in a lot of different ways. But in Raging Sea, I saw her as somebody who got both sides of the story and realized the importance of everything that was going on, not just the scale of the Alpha and what was happening with the war that they were fighting, but also on a human level. And right. Brittany and I were trying to come up with a question about Lyric, but it was mostly just, you know, okay, here's our Lyric praise section, because we kind of don't know what else to say, because she's such a wonderful, complicated character and so strong considering everything that she goes through.
Oh, well, that, you can't get a better compliment than that. I really appreciate it. I read a lot of YA before I wrote this book, because I wanted to make sure that I could do it. And I wasn't even sure I could when I started to write, because some of the best books I've ever written are YA. The best books ever written are YA sometimes. And I have friends who do it, and I'm in awe of what they're capable of doing with words. So I read a lot of these books, and what I found over and over and over was this sort of archetype female character that really needed somebody to rescue her. And I think in my life and you know, from when I was a kid until now, the people, the women that I've always been friends with or attracted to or married, were always sort of butt-kicking heroes who weren't waiting for anybody to rescue them. They just do it themselves. And I tried to do that with this, with Lyric. I wanted to create a character that was cool, which you don't usually see in YA. Most YA characters, they're sort of like frumpy, and they, you know, they're like, they're quietly beautiful, but they've never noticed. And then some guy comes along and shows them that they were always beautiful. But Lyric knows that she's hot, and she enjoys the attention, and she enjoys being, you know, the queen bee and being at the top of the popularity food chain. She sort of enjoys that, but at the same time, I think she has a kindness about her and a concern for other people. And this was what I wanted to offer the YA world, was maybe something that they weren't getting, which was, you know, a girl who can kick a little ass, you know, but can also cry, because I think that's kind of what most women are.
Yeah,
I know you can't see me right now, but I'm like throwing my hands up in praise. So, yes. Oh,
yeah, yes, for the past couple of days, Karen and I have been talking, and every time she's like, "Do we have any more questions?" And I'm like, "I really want to ask a question about Lyric," but every time I just typed her name, I just wrote "so strong" after it in our chats. Like, if she screenshots our chats, it's just like, "Lyric, so strong." And then it's like, "But I can't come up with a question about it."
Yeah.
Because I just think she's so different that it's just refreshing to not be like, "Well, why did you do this with her? Why did you do that with her?" Because it's something so original and unique, and it's not a character I've read 100 times. Like, yeah, YA is great, but they're the same characters.
I mean, she's based on friends and you know, my wife and old relationships. I mean, she's an amalgamation of some very strong women who I've been blessed to know. And so I'm glad that people are picking up on that, because, you know, I love so much of what's out there, but I do feel like every once in a while you got to do something different with these main characters, because they get a little predictable. I hope that that's what I gave everybody, was like an unpredictable superhero. And
in my opinion, you definitely achieved all of that and more. I really like Lyric.
I like her too. I think that if I had known her in high school, I would have been way too intimidated by her to like be friends with her. But I think that I would have probably harbored a crush on her until, you know, forever. She's pretty fun. I enjoy writing her, so that's always a good sign.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, last, like, straight-up question about this series is that, considering the giant cliffhanger that we previously talked about that was really unfair, what can we expect from the final book in the series? Anything that you can tease us about yet?
Well, I can tell you that that keeping with some of the like current event stuff that I've tried to put in the book, and the political and historical information that sort of reflects things that have happened in America, that, you know, Lyric is going to return to the shores in an attempt to be a peacemaker and try to unite humanity and the Alpha. And that's really the gist of the third book, is the troubles that she'll have doing that. And I've got to sort of tie up this relationship she has with the boy. And because I have to admit right now that, you know, I had this conversation with my editor just a couple days ago. And I was like, you know what, I feel like in the second book, Fathom, really comes off as very feminist. He has a very cold way of saying it, but he basically says, I expect you to be able to rescue yourself. I'm not here to save you. I'm here to love you. And it's a very bold conversation for them to have. And then I realize that this relationship is so complicated and almost impossible. And I wonder if Lyric will choose it. You know, and I think that that's going to be, something that happens in the book is the struggle of, can they actually be together? Like, everybody might want them to be together, but is it at all realistic? So that's going to be a part of it. Many times throughout the book, the Alpha talk about the Great Abyss, which is their god. And I will say that Lyric is going to come face to face with the Great Abyss.
Ooh, that's exciting.
That is.
Yes. And, I don't want to give away too much more, but I just wrote a couple of pages today on it where something happened that completely spins the book around, and I was stunned. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is going to be so much more work to make this work, But I was like, I can't not do that. You know, the people who love this character in these books are going to want this. So I realize I'm making myself a big headache, but you know, it's a great, amazing experience. So I would say not more of the same, but more of the different. That's what I can offer you.
Okay, well, you somehow just made the wait between books like 1,000 times worse.
Sorry.
But I welcome it. It'll just make the third book even more fulfilling.
Yeah, yeah. And I've had such a great time writing it. And I'm eager to start something new too. So we'll see. This has been a great experience.
Awesome. Now, we want to talk a little bit about just sci-fi and fantasy creatures in general, because, of course, we have the Alpha in your books, which are really cool and interesting and different. So Brittany's going to kick off this section about some of our favorites across literature.
Yeah. Okay. So our first question is, do you have a favorite book or movie monster?
Wow. I would say... my favorite monster is from Doctor Who, and it's this creature is called the Weeping Angels. Do you guys know that?
Yes.
Karen would. I do not know. Yeah. I don't watch Doctor Who, but Karen would know.
Well, what they are is they look like statues that you might see in a cemetery of angels. But the problem is that when you look away from them, they move closer to you.
It's the worst.
And then they gang up on you. Eventually, when they get close enough, their faces contort into this like monstrous, hideous, almost like vampire face. And I think those things are so unsettling. Let me see. I saw The Witch this weekend.
I've heard good things about that.
which was really troubling. And The Conjuring is one of those movies that I think also completely freaked me out. But I would say my favorite movie monster is probably Freddy Krueger, at least in the early Freddy Krueger movies. He got a little campy and ridiculous at the end, but in the first two, he's really scary.
Yeah, my favorite movie monster is not my favorite, but the one that scares me the most are, the aliens from Signs, because I don't like aliens, and they terrified me as a child, and I used to, like, live next to a field, and it was just very traumatizing for me. but also, the creature from Jeepers Creepers who, like, drives that insane truck with the horn in, like, broad daylight. Anything in broad daylight, just forget it. Don't sign me up. I can't deal with it. I can deal with nighttime things that pop out, But yeah, the, like, aliens walking across in full daylight in that one clip in Signs, and then the Jeepers Creepers monster just being up on Earth. I'm like, I can't do that.
I was just thinking about that clip when you said that movie. That's the scene.
That's the scene where they pause the video, and I'm like, no, 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 because it takes too long for it to happen. It takes too long.
It's so wrong.
It's so wrong.
And he times it perfectly. Yeah, that's very scary. I totally approve of those scary monsters.
What about
if
you,
the monster's badass enough to walk out in broad daylight? You know they're trouble.
Yeah,
I hate Jeepers Creepers. Killed me. I don't even like thinking about it.
Well, that was how they introduced the clown in American Horror Story. These two people are having a picnic, and then the clown just walks out in the field in broad daylight. And I was like, no, I was ready for the darkness. I had my pillow next to me, waiting for the dark scene to come, and he just walked across the field. And I was like, nope, I'm done. I'm out.
Yeah, I would say the Purple Man in Jessica Jones was truly frightening. I mean David Tennant is such a great actor, and like everything he touches is just so special, but you know, when he's like playing the villain, which I'd never seen him do before, and I have to admit, like, I'm a sort of a comic book nerd, so I know where the Purple Man comes from, and the Purple Man is easily the dumbest supervillain in all of Marvel Comics. And so, like, when I was like, they're going to use the Purple Man? That's stupid. But they bring him in, and like, he is terrifying to me. I mean, like, every episode of that, it was like, this man, you know, you're, like, rooting for him to be murdered.
Like, it's worse, too, because they spend so much of the series with him off screen, and it's just her, like, hearing his voice and kind of being messed up by what's already happened to him. You're like, he's not even on screen yet, and I'm already terrified.
Yeah. That's a truly scary, scary character.
Mm-hmm. Well, my favorite monster is zombies. I'm really obsessed with zombies. I don't know why. I don't know how this came about. I used to not watch any horror anything at all. And now I live for zombies. Love The Walking Dead. Decided that I really wanted to see Pride and Prejudice and Zombies because that just looked really awesome. And
it was really awesome.
Yeah. It was incredible.
I loved the book.
Yeah, well, see, I did the... This has been a thing on Book Hype for the
last... This is why we've talked about Pride and Prejudice for the past three episodes.
Because I'm doing everything backwards. I saw the movie, then I read the book, and now eventually maybe I might have to read Pride and Prejudice for the first time.
Yeah.
And then she has to watch the Pride and Prejudice adaptations.
Yeah. I think Pride and Prejudice is a really brilliant novel and very, very funny. It doesn't get the credit for being funny, but it really is.
Yeah, that was one of the things that Karen asked about it. She's like, are the jokes just for the zombies? And I'm like, no. That's like Austin humor. You got to read it.
Yeah. Yeah. She's like, that character is such a ball buster. I mean, I hate to use that word, but she's like, she never lets up on anybody. And I love that novel. That is easily one of my favorite books. And what I loved about when they add the zombies is that just like the novel just keeps going the way it did. It's just, but there's zombies outside the window. You know, like, very little problems with the zombies at all in the novel. But, you know, because the relationships are still going on, it's just like, oh, the ball is ruined because a zombie got into the kitchen, you know. But yeah, I've been wanting to see that. So you would say go see that?
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yeah, it steps up the zombie game from the book. It's a lot. It changes a few things, and it's better for it.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
And Brittany doesn't even like zombies.
Yeah, I don't like zombies.
Yeah.
So
I wouldn't see it.
28 Days Later is one of my favorite zombie movies because the zombies start running.
Oh God.
That's the game changer for zombies because they're always like sort of staggering and you can't take them seriously because you can sort of just walk quickly and you're all right. But in this movie, the zombies actually sprint after you. And I remember,
didn't that happen in World War Z too?
Yeah, I think they stole it. Yeah. They stole it from 28 Days Later, but it is troubling when to watch them like full like Bruce Jenner run at you is not good, you know, it's not good.
I do enjoy Shaun of the Dead, which is not really a true zombie movie, but it's hilarious.
That one actually
made me sick to my stomach. I can watch The Walking Dead every day of my life. Can't handle Shaun of the Dead. I don't understand.
Is it just because it's too, you know, he's got a bat and it's just too, too violent and funny?
It was the scene where they eat the intestines. That was so real. And I was a little bit younger, like, maybe I could handle it now, but I just remember, like, wanting to die because it was so horrible.
Have you ever seen their other movie, Hot Fuzz?
Yeah. I'm a huge Simon Pegg fan. So.
Yeah, there's a couple scenes in that movie where I'm like, oh, that's horrific. I like zombies, too. I think, you know, what I would really love to do is create a brand new kind of monster. Because we sort of keep doing the werewolf, vampire, zombie thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody's really created a new monster in at least a decade that it seems to have some sort of impact on the public.
Right.
You know, we just keep rehashing the same ones, and I'd love to like create something that was like brand new.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I could do without some vampires for a while. Even though I'm committed to a 3-year Buffy rewatch at the moment, I can do without some vampires for the moment.
Well, Buffy, you know, there's always an exception with that.
So what are some of your favorite creatures from mythology? Because, like, I know I love a good griffin every now and then to appear.
Cerebus, the three-headed dog that guards the gates to hell. I always find that to be rather amusing. When I was a kid, they made this movie called Clash of the Titans, which I know they remade a few years ago, but it had a Medusa in it. And for some reason, that always freaked me out. And there was also a lot of like warriors who were just skeletons. So if you knocked them down, their bones would fall apart, but the bones would reassemble and come after
like
them.
Like in Mario.
yeah, exactly. I think those are my favorite. I think the things that always were unsettling to me was in that movie. It's such a kind of a goofy movie now because the special effects are not great, even for that time period. But it still does it for me.
Karen is a huge mythology buff, so mm-hmm. I want her to tell me her favorite character, because I don't even think I know this, and I hear her talk about mythology a lot.
Yeah, Greek mythology in particular is just, I don't know, I love it so, so, so much, and it's really hard to choose, it is, because I love all of the different stories, and I love some of the newer twists on the way that those creatures are handled. Of course, I'm talking about Percy Jackson, one of my all-time favorite series, because I cannot get through an episode of Book Hype without talking about Percy Jackson at least twice. But I really love the Sphinx, because that one in particular is about the riddles, and I think that's really clever, the way that kind of comes about. And I also like Pegasus. I mean, you gotta love Pegasus. Mm-hmm. There's just a winged horse, and of course I'm thinking of Hercules, because...
Again, we can't get through an episode of Book Club without talking about Hercules.
There are a lot of things that are repetitious on Book Club, but that's how we got through 105 episodes. So,
yeah.
But I just think Pegasus is really fun and would be a great buddy to have in a bind.
Yeah, well, that leads us into like another interesting concept, because Pegasus is, of course, you know, a winged horse. So if you could mash several animals together, what would you pick to put together?
Oh, well, if I wanted to create a really great monster, it would have to have like a bear, but like parts of a bear. I just saw
it's
the
very
Revenant.
Topical right now.
Yeah. Yeah. The Revenant, that the scene in that movie, with the bear is Oh, I don't think I'll ever forget that. I don't know how they did it. It's amazing. So I like a bear that could fly, like have wings, and it would just fall out of the sky onto you.
Oh, it's
I mean,
terrifying.
that isn't it horrible? Yeah, I think that. But I've always thought, like, one of the things when I talk to children, I'm always fascinated by how many people love unicorns. And but the way I see it is like a unicorn is like a horse with a dagger on its head, and like if it was running at you, you wouldn't like want to hug. I mean, you it's like that thing's gonna impale me. I mean, it's a very dangerous creature. But yeah, I think like the flying bear. I have to come up with a name for that, but that would be just this 500-pound. No, I guess they're like 1,000 pounds, 1,000-pound creature.
Be a
Falls out
big
of the sky
wingspan.
and mauls you. It wouldn't seem
Wouldn't even
fair.
have to. It would just land on you and you'd be dead.
Yeah, I think that would be it. I think I've created something truly unsettling there.
Yeah, I was gonna say like a fish that could fly, but now that there's a bear who can maul me, and I bet it has like really insane talons, they're like, no, you
just.
can't.
It's horrible. Yeah, I have to put like a patch on its eye and like make it sort of semi-intelligent.
A terrifying thought to have. I probably will now not go see the Revenant, so I don't have an image of that bear now with wings.
That thing had wings, that movie would have won Best Picture.
That's all it was missing.
Yeah, it's like, you gotta put wings on
It's like
stuff.
3 more hours of CGI work and they could have had it.
Yeah, I mean that director should have really known better. It was
Seriously.
a rookie mistake.
What about you, Karen?
Well, whenever I want to mash animals together, I like to them to be cute and fluffy. So I was going in the opposite direction. But my favorite animal is the cheetah. So I'd have to cross the cheetah with something. And I don't know what would be good. Like, I was thinking wolf because I really like wolves, but they're not that different. That's not like putting, a bear and a bird together. So I was trying to think like maybe a bunny. I don't know, something to make it really fluffy and cute, and then I could
Like a
keep
poodle,
it. Yes.
the world's fastest poodle.
A cheetoodle.
A
Have
cheetoodle.
you seen that commercial, the puppy
Oh
monkey baby?
no, puppy
No,
monkey baby.
I can't talk about it.
It makes me sick.
It does.
I watch it and I'm like, oh, that I should be amused by this, but it's too.
No.
I don't know if I think it's too real. I don't know what's going on with my head when I watch it, but it makes me nauseous.
Also, like
Same.
the head of that dog looks like my dog, so it's just really unsettling.
For me, it's the baby legs. I can't. That's just too much. If it was puppy monkey chicken, I would probably think that was hilarious. But the body part, the lower body part with the diaper, I'm like, no.
See,
That's not right. That's
that's
a
so
sin
funny
against
because
God.
I think my problem is with the monkey because you have the monkey and you think it's going to be a monkey, and then you look up and it's a dog, and you look down and it has baby legs, and you're just like, my mind is blown. But yeah, that commercial traumatizes me. I shudder every time it comes on, and we have to mute the television because it's just too much.
There's something to hate for everyone in the
Yes.
puppy monkey
And we
baby.
covered all of it here on Book Hype.
Everybody gets their own part to be troubled by.
But speaking of more adorable creatures, there are some really great fictional mythological creatures in books right now. And I'm going to cheat and go back a little bit for mine because I'm looking at it sitting on my desk, and it's a Pygmy Puff from the Harry Potter books. I think they are adorable, and I went to the Universal Park and I had mine in a naming ceremony, and it was great, and it was probably the happiest I've ever been in the Harry Potter park. And I was 24, so
I always
watch.
liked The Littles. You
Oh,
guys remember that book series?
yeah.
Yeah, and they had tails, and they were little, like about an inch high, and they lived in the cupboards, and they had pointy ears, but they looked like people. That's something that somebody needs to bring back.
The Littles. I forgot about the Littles.
Awesome. Yeah, it's sort of like the borrowers.
But, yeah, but they're like the borrowers, but they're not. They have tails.
They have more animal-like qualities.
What about you, Karen? Do you have any favorites?
I mean, I'm going to cheat in a different way and just say anything from Harry Potter. Like, in particular, I love the way that she uses the mythological creatures, and I just think that her books have such a variety of different types of creatures, and it's so much to remember that every time I reread them, it's like you're discovering them again, and I really enjoy that. So,
and we're only getting
kind
more.
Of a cheat because yes, please.
And you've been to Harry Potter World in Florida at Universal.
Yes, I was just there and I cried so much. There were so many tears.
It really is spectacular.
It's overwhelmingly amazing.
Being able to have a butterbeer is pretty great. Even though a butterbeer would easily give you diabetes.
It was very sweet.
The sweetest thing I think I've ever tasted. And then I discovered that Starbucks actually has a recipe for that.
Mm-hmm. You got to get the butterscotch, and then it's just, it's very good.
I think it's like 90 pumps of butterscotch.
Yeah. And a shot of espresso to help it go down.
Yeah. And, of course, you can't forget the whipped cream that they put on it.
Really. And a drizzle on top. Because you're already there.
If I'm going to have butterbeer... Yeah. I want to do it right.
Everyone comes with some insulin and and one of those testing strips to make sure that your blood sugar is okay. That the butterbeer is pretty amazing. I bought one for my son when I was there, which was literally like just giving him, like rocket fuel, and he ran around the park like a lunatic until we get to the part where the dragon scares everybody with the fire, and then he screamed.
When I was there, I went by myself because none of my friends wanted to really go. We went to Disney and then whatever.
That's nuts. You need better friends.
They left Florida and I stayed in Florida longer to go. And I went there and I'm like, all right, I'm getting the Universal Hopper Pass so I could do both sides of the Harry Potter world. Like, and then once I'm done with Harry Potter, I can go and like ride the Hulk and then go back. 8 hours later, never left the Harry Potter park. I was like, oh my gosh, I have the rest of Universal like at my fingertips. And I walked around and I was like, I'm done. I didn't do anything.
you didn't even like go over to the Springfield, the Simpsons place?
No, I went to the SpongeBob store, and I went through the Dr. Seuss area, but that's only because you have to walk through the Dr. Seuss area to exit the Harry Potter park. Mm-hmm. That's all I did. I like looked at my watch and I was like, it's been 8 hours and I have not left.
The Simpsons thing is really pretty fun. There's not a lot of rides there, but they have built it to.
Oh yeah. I walked through that on my way in. And it was closed still. So nothing was open. But I did see, like, all the exterior stuff.
Yeah, it was I had a lot of fun over there. I always feel like Universal sort of misses opportunities. Mm-hmm. They made Back to the Future, and they don't make a big deal of it there. And for me, Back to the Future is the greatest movie ever made. And I can't imagine why they don't have a Back to the Future ride.
That is odd. Do they still have the Twister ride? Because that terrified me as a child. I didn't go looking for it when I went back.
I think
like
they
the movie
did,
Twister?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was like, it's sort of like you stand there and you watch a Twister happen.
That sounds like my nightmare.
That was all it was.
Yeah. It's like, moving to a trailer park.
Yeah. But I still can't watch the part where like Aunt May's house, or Aunt May, goes, like she gets attacked by the Twister, because it just makes me so uncomfortable and unsettled. As soon as her wind chimes start going, I either have to turn it off and walk away and come back.
You're ready to get out.
I'm like, I gotta wait until they're done. And then when they're at the movie theater, I just can't, the drive-in movie. I, for some reason, I can't watch those two scenes of Twister. It, like, makes me very uncomfortable.
They have an E.T. ride there, too, that's, that is kind of disappointing.
Yeah, speaking of uncomfortable, that is a terrifying alien.
It's just like, it's basically a bunch of, like, stuffed dolls on the ride, and you rolled around on a bicycle, and it sort of acts as a sequel to the movie. Like, yeah. You wind up going back to the planet, the green planet with E.T.
Yeah, that was weird. I did like the Shrek 4D experience, though. I think it's now Minions, but it was Shrek when I was there. The first time I went on it, and it was
It's Minions now, yeah.
Unfortunate, because Shrek was so good.
Yeah. I was traumatized by the bug one for, like, four-year-olds because they, like, poke you in the back.
Oh, and that thing hurts.
To be the bugs.
I remember.
I was terrified. anyway, this is turning into confession time. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
What is your deepest Universal Studios confession?
So we want to just finish out the episode with what I'm hoping is going to be a fun flash fiction game. And if this episode's ridiculousness is anything to go by, I think it's going to be fantastic.
All right.
So I'm very excited. So basically what we have now is two lists, and Brittany's in charge of that, and she's going to use a random generator to pick a topic out of column A and a topic out of column B. And first person, and Michael, I hope you don't mind, we've volunteered you as the first person, as the resident, you know, author here, to just come up with one sentence, mashing these two words together in some way, and then we're going to do a double round robin where Brittany's going to go next and just follow up your sentence with one of her own, and we're just going to have a six-sentence story between the three of us.
Oh, okay, so we're doing a story.
Yes, and just see what comes out of our mouths.
All right.
So we have 10 and 5. So our story is going to be Apocalypse Amulet. Nice alliteration.
Apocalypse Amulet.
Or you can add a the in there, the Apocalypse Amulet.
So then I write, I just give you a sentence using those two words.
Actually, I like Brittany's idea. Yeah, I like Brittany's idea of this just being the title of our story. That makes a little bit more sense.
Okay. Let me think here. Okay. You never know what you'll find at the thrift store.
It was a Tuesday when I entered, and I saw an old crate lurking in the back corner.
As I lifted the top of the crate, a shiny golden amulet caught my eye.
"If you break it, you bought it," shouted the old man who ran the store.
So I quickly exited, noticing a giant lump in my pocket as I ran into the street.
As my fingers brushed the side of the amulet, everyone around me turned into zombies. The end.
That is very sad.
It was an apocalypse amulet.
It was an apocalypse amulet.
Oh.
All right. I'm laying claim to all of the stories that come out of this.
If we get a dedication, you know, to book hype.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It is.
You want to do it again?
We can if you want to.
Let's see what happens. It's going to be fun.
All right. So let's. Our next topic, our title is 5 and 6. So, Lunar Library. What is with the alliteration?
Lunar Library. Okay, I'll start. The first manned trip to the moon came with a massive surprise. when Neil Armstrong came back with a library card from the Lunar Library.
The volumes contained in the Lunar Library weren't vast, but they did hold the secrets of the universe.
Now, if only Neil Armstrong could keep his Lunar Library card out of the hands of his arch nemesis, Mark Watney.
Mark took the card back to the Lunar Library, all the way to the moon. He checked out a book, but just like Mark, he never returned it.
Little did he know that when he was stranded on Mars, his fate was already written on the last page. Oh, I had a great follow-up sentence to that.
And from within his pocket, he produced the apocalypse amulet. And as his fingers touched the side, everyone around him was turned into a zombie. But seeing as he was the only person on the moon, ..
But I just sent him to Mars.
I mean Mars. He was the only person on Mars.
In Mars, they use the screwy decimal system.
Oh, well, we covered all the Oscar noms that we care about.
Yes. We kind of did, actually.
Although I still think that the mythological flying bear is more terrifying than Mark Watney on Mars facing himself as a zombie.
Yeah. Yeah. What was going to be your follow-up sentence?
Well, since his fate was inscribed on the last page, I was going to say, too bad he forgot to pack it.
I mean, that does sound like Mark Watney. Okay, well, that's basically our episode. I want to say thank you so, so much to Michael Buckley for joining us. It was a lot of fun. And hopefully this is something that we can continue doing if you guys like it. And considering we talked about zombies and flying bears and apocalypse amulets, I don't see what there wasn't, you know, I don't see what there wasn't to like. So
you didn't like it. You have expectations that are just out of control.
Yes, yes. So yes, thank you again for joining us. We really appreciated it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, ladies. I had a really fun time.
Awesome. And everybody should read Raging Sea because it's awesome. And also, if you want to listen to our book hype review of Undertow, I'll throw a link in our show notes so you can check that out too.
Great. Okay. Bye.
Bye. Goodbye, Mark Watney, wherever you are. Bye-bye. I hear
something
you.
Has to go wrong at least once.
Yeah.
That's why we have backups. It's fine.
Yeah.
Skype is the most amazing technology that never worked.
Yes. That is exactly how I would describe it.
That and the PowerPoint. I've never actually seen a PowerPoint presentation. Because every time I've ever been somewhere where an author has one, it has never worked. Like, oh, we forgot the wrong, we had that one adapter, and then oh, this one doesn't accept a Mac, or I just can't find the file. You know, it's like I've never seen one actually work.
Come to think of it, the last author presentation I went to was for Rick Riordan, and it was at least 10 minutes before his PowerPoint was up and running.
I know. I think it's just a way of killing time.